credit union exists in service to its members. So its depositors and its borrowers constitute really its ownership. And we take our profitability and we roll that back in a benefit to our members. In the case of Alliant Credit Union, it's oftentimes paying one of the highest savings rate in the country on our depository accounts.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to another episode of the Passive Income Pilots. I'm the co-host, Ryan Gibson, and I'm here with Tate Duryea. Tate, how are you doing?
Hey, doing great, man. Very excited for today's episode. We just had a long conversation with Charles Kravitz, who is the Senior Vice President and Chief Capital Markets Officer for Alliant Credit Union. Ryan, that was a heck of a conversation.
Yeah, he's also the head of lending there. So you're probably wondering, like, why are we bringing on the head guy at a credit union? Well, there's a lot of benefits to banking with a credit union. You may be with a more national bank or a global bank. That's not giving you the best interest rates, or it's not giving you the best cash back on a credit card, or isn't giving you the best home loan or auto loan. And so joining a union, or otherwise joining a credit union like Alliant, might be more beneficial to your overall personal finance, or joining Wings Financial. We're not slating any certain credit union, but we want to make it aware that a lot of these credit unions like Alliant are now completely virtual. And so they can give you the best rate and terms on a lot of personal finance stuff. So we wanted to bring Charles on for that. And we also brought on Thomas Eddy, who's he's our director of capital markets here at Spartan, who's going to talk about how he finds loans for commercial real estate. And so Charles is actually a commercial real estate lender from the credit union side. So we're going to hear how the bank thinks before they lend you money. And then we're going to hear how working with a commercial mortgage broker will help you get some of the best commercial lending opportunities. So we kind of go, this episode was, it's kind of like a pool. We have like the shallow end and we have the deep end. So we start with some basics, talking about what a
credit union is. Yeah, then it gets pretty dense.
Yeah, and we just go right off the deep end. So if you're listening to this and you're a full-time active real estate investor and you're trying to find the best commercial loan for your property, you're going to have a lot of nuggets at the end. If you're someone's like, I'm not getting any commercial loans, but I just kind of want to hear how the sausage is made, this is a great episode for that.
Absolutely. And so full open kimono, Alliant Credit Union has given some bucks to Spartan. I know that you guys have a great relationship. One of the reasons why we were able to get him on. So thank you for that. One of the terms thrown around in the episode is CMBS. I just want to touch on that briefly so that nobody's lost. And that is a commercial mortgage-backed securities. So it's just a fancy way of saying a mortgage note that's backed by real estate. Additionally, something that's interesting is that Alliant up until 2003 was the United Airlines Employees Credit Union for 87 years. From 1935 until 2003, they opened their doors to the public in 2003 and have become a really tech-enabled, very, very digital native credit union. So very, very cool. Should check them out.
Yeah.
Anything you want to touch on before we get into it?
Yeah, they actually they were like one of the first airline crew or airline credit unions, I think, ever. So Charles is actually going to tell us the story about how Alliant got its start in like an airplane hangar in like the 1930s. So
that was it's incredible.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. And so, yeah, I think this episode is going to cover a lot of ground. So with that, let's get into it.
Let's get to the show.
Well, thanks for joining us, Charles and Thomas Eddy. Charles Kravitz is from Alliant Credit Union, which is formerly the United Airline Pilots Credit Union that transitioned, and we're going to get into that today. But I'm excited that we're going to be able to give a landscape of the lending market right now. Alliant Credit Union lends nationally and has lent to a lot of self-storage projects, actually. And Thomas Eddy here is on my team in the capital markets division of Spartan. And he helps lenders or helps borrowers find loans. He also is responsible for the hundreds of millions of dollars of loans that Spartan has done over the years. So, gentlemen, we'll start with you, Charles. Welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, certainly great to be here. Before I turn the spotlight on myself, I would like to, you know, say that in 1935, October 26, 1935, United Airlines started the United Airlines Employee Credit Union. It was headquartered out of a hangar in Midway Airport. The credit union grew to a whopping 779 members by January 1st, 1938. And in 1940, hired its first paid employee. And then by 1949, the credit union had grown significantly to 5,451 members. That represented 56% of all United Airlines employees at the time. In 1954, we had 16 staffers, and the average account balance was $345. And interesting to note that savings accounts were limited to $3,500. That's the most that you were allowed to have. So just a very interesting start. In 2000, 2003, we spun off of United Airlines and we changed our name to Alliant and opened up our membership a little bit more broadly at that time. You know, and right now we have over 700,000 members. The majority, or the, I shouldn't say the majority, the largest group of members are United Airlines related folks, current, former employees and family members. And we are about $19 billion in assets. So tremendous growth. $2 billion of our assets around are in commercial real estate. My background really has been in commercial real estate finance for the majority of my career. I came out of my undergraduate program in 1987. So despite not looking so old, only because I shaved my gray hair off, I am older. Then went into commercial real estate finance, came out of grad school, London School of Economics in 1991, where I got a master's in regional and urban planning, kind of the closest I could find at the time to international real estate, and have been involved in a variety of commercial real estate financing platforms. Principally at LaSalle Bank out of Chicago, where we built a very large CMBS lending platform, and at other times in my career in the small balance space, particularly specializing in small balance multifamily properties. And then found myself at Alliant Credit Union in 2017 and took over a very, very small commercial platform there. I think at the time it was under $300 million in balances. And like I said, we've grown that to close to $2 billion in balances. Generally speaking, focused on larger loan sizes with extremely experienced borrowers. We've had tremendous both growth and performance.
That's incredible. And your title now at Alliant, I understand, as Senior Vice President, Chief Capital Markets Officer, and Head of Commercial Lending. That's quite a title.
That is, because I do a bunch of other things other than commercial real estate. I head up our loan trading business. So we buy and sell commercial, residential, and consumer loans. And last year, our volume in that business was roughly $1.6 billion of purchases and sales. And then I also am involved in our fintech partnership cultivation areas. So we have relationships with a variety of lenders. Some of them are in the solar loan space. Some of them are in the personal term loan space. Others in the home equity line of credit space. So a variety of fintech relationships that I am directly involved in overseeing and incubating. And more recently, I have gotten involved on the depository side in an area known as select employee groups. So this is really offering credit union membership as an employee benefit to astute companies that want to look out for the financial wellness of their employees, and also extending that into the kind of association space as well. And Ryan, as you know, I'm very hopeful that we'll figure out how to direct all the folks listening to this podcast to Alliant Credit Union as well.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. You know, I know Tate's is dying to jump in here to kind of get back to basics on the credit union stuff, but we have the guy at Alliant, at a major credit union, to answer all of our questions today. So, Charles, we really appreciate you joining us. You know, go ahead, Tate. We'll take us away with the first question.
Yeah, Charles, thank you so much for joining us. You're extraordinarily accomplished and a very busy guy. So we really appreciate you coming on. The first thing that I wanted to sort of lay the groundwork for the audience is the difference between a credit union and a bank, because I think that can sometimes you just sort of get lost in the shuffle of life, and you grow up and then you're embarrassed to ask the question. How do they differ, and what are the benefits, pros, cons of each?
So great, great question. One that when I joined Alliant in 2017, I was a little bit confused by. I did not really know what a credit union was per se, but a credit union exists in service to its members. So its depositors and its borrowers constitute really its ownership. And we take our profitability and we roll that back in a benefit to our members. In the case of Alliant Credit Union, it's oftentimes paying one of the highest savings rate in the country on our depository accounts, be it a savings account or a share certificate, which is really another term for a CD, or lower rates than are on offer for car loans, home loans, you name it. So taking the profitability we generate and deploying that back in benefit to our members, whereas a bank is, a for-profit operation that benefits its shareholders and may be incentive to behave in a way that is different than how a credit union, might behave.
So I understand that, credit unions can often be a lot better than working with a bank. So could you share your thoughts on why everybody isn't part of a credit union, and why would you bank with Chase if you could bank with a local credit union? What are some drawbacks maybe for some smaller operations?
So I wouldn't say better by any means. I would say a little bit different. Like I said, there are likely to be better rates on offer from a credit union, but it's a generalization, not always. Alliant Credit Union happens to be an all digital platform. We do not have any branches, no bricks and mortar. We save a lot of money by not having the expenditures on facilities, and we're able to take those savings again and turn that back over to our membership, as opposed to increased dividends to shareholders, not a concern really with a stock price, but a concern with creating member value. So some very fundamental motivational, drivers. But, why would you, to your question more specifically, why would you go with Chase? Well, maybe you're old school. You like to walk into a location. Chase has plenty of those. That is for sure. Right. Maybe you've got this weird desire to get paid, not all that much on your savings and checking account. And I'm obviously being facetious here, but it's a cost and benefit payoff. So in order to have the convenience of those walk-in locations to the people that, value that, and not everyone does, a lot of people are moving away from, or actually finding the need to go in somewhere to be inconvenient, as opposed to having your credit union or your bank, in the palm of your hand as a highly rated customer service oriented app, or someone like Alliant who augments that with a 24/7 call center and kind of a first in class online banking experience.
Yeah, I can definitely tell you there's a bank that I work with, unfortunate that I have a HELOC with them, and I haven't been able to get rid of it. And the fact that I have to go into a branch to do literally anything with them is a massive pain.
So, right, but a lot, but again, a lot of people want that. You know, it's clear that there are those people who, for whatever reason, feel the comfort level of transacting in person.
Right, right. Well, what about membership? So if someone wants to go open up a checking account at a credit union, can anyone do that?
So that's, it depends. There's different types of credit unions. There's a lot of federally chartered credit unions, and then there's, you know, some state chartered credit unions. Alliant happens to be a state chartered credit union in Illinois. And the rules of membership are different. So typically credit unions are known as kind of serving the firefighters who live within a, you know, a 3-square block radius. And that's kind of more of a traditional arrangement with credit unions. Other credit unions have different ways of becoming a member. And like I was saying earlier, one of the ways at Alliant is to work for an employer who is concerned about financial wellness, wants to deliver first-in-class products to their employees, and enters into what's known as a select employee group relationship with a credit union. So that's, you know, that's one way, and a way that I personally am touting. But there's other means. Some credit unions allow you to make a charitable contribution and join a particular charity, which then allows you to get credit union membership as well. So it varies extensively. There's a lot of military-oriented credit unions. The largest credit union, Navy Federal Credit Union, you know, serving the military. So some broad categories like that as well.
That's excellent. Well, Ryan, I'll kick it back to you. I just wanted to set the table and give people a little bit of context around credit unions. Really excited to talk about commercial lending. We've got Thomas Eddy on the line. So Ryan, I'm going to kick it back to you and let's jump into commercial lending.
And I think that today's episode, Tate, we kind of caught up, you know, in the beginning and talked about, like, how is this applicable to somebody who's not going out and getting a commercial loan in real estate? Well, you can benefit from Alliant efficiency and join online and have online banking and maybe get better interest rates, better CDs, better products, better service, right, through that app. And I think Definitely. That's really
yes.
kind of my takeaway from that. And, you know, Charles' team does a great job of that. On the backside, you know, when you're thinking about, you know, how does Spartan get a loan? How does an operator get a loan? How do I go find commercial financing? We're going to talk about the state of the market. We're going to talk about kind of how the sausage is made in loans, and Thomas, we keep talking about you here, you know, kind of how Thomas makes that all happen at Spartan Investment Group as our capital markets leader in all of our loans and acquiring those. But Thomas, why don't you real quick just kind of introduce yourself? I don't mean to keep skipping over you here. Welcome to the show.
No, thanks. And I'll keep it short here. I don't have quite the same resume as Charles on the call, but I will say I've got last 15 years in the lending space, starting out on the residential side, and then the last about 8 years on the commercial side. So that's my background, having most recently worked for JP Morgan. So coming over now on the other side of the desk in the lending aisle. And one thing I might say for your listeners as well is, even if you're not out there looking for a loan, understanding how different operators are obtaining them is important as you're looking for that passive income and where are you placing that money. Knowing what questions to ask maybe, or understanding how that investment is capitalized, could be very important to the realized returns.
Yeah.
So with that being
definitely. No, I was going to say that's a really good point, especially right now when a lot of projects have floating rate debt and investors didn't realize that, and that could be impacting returns. So really good points.
It's really neat for me to be, on the same podcast with Thomas, because, you know, Thomas has access to all capital sources and I'm just one. So it's a good opportunity for me to learn a little bit about how Alliant Credit Union stacks up against other capital sources, and even to explore how some credit unions, you know, vary. What I found is most credit unions have a tendency to lend very, very locally and tend to lend smaller amounts of money, call it $1 through $5 million. And there's only a few credit unions nationally that will lend larger dollars and further afield. And it's just interesting to understand, you know, I guess, Thomas, you're out there looking for a loan on a self-storage property. Do you go to that local credit union? Do you go to a smaller bank? Do you search for that national lender? You know, what typically goes into that decision making?
Yeah, it's a great question, Charles, to even your point. I've had this conversation several times this week alone, as I think a lot of banks and credit unions are asking, what are we seeing in the marketplace? Just because everyone's trying to figure it out right now, because it is such an interesting time in the debt markets and banking relationship. So typically our strategy, first and foremost, depending on where the property is that we're buying or the we're trying to finance, we'll go to that local market. You know, who do we know in the area who might be open to it? If we have existing relationships, leveraging those first, of course. So if it's an Alliance footprint, then it might be a good Alliance deal. Charles, you hear from me first. Otherwise, if we don't have someone immediately identifiable, that's exactly the strategy. Is we start looking to see who's local, who's super regional and comfortable with that area, as they're typically going to be the best lending option, both because they could be well-versed in the market and so more comfortable with the financing deal, as well as working with those smaller banks, they typically have faster response times and better terms. And when I say banks, I also mean credit unions, capital providers.
And then what about life insurance companies? You turn to those opportunities at all?
We look at life companies as well. Typically, what we found is that debt's a little bit longer term, or there is a more expensive exit known as yield maintenance or defeasance. And so it doesn't give us as much flexibility as we would otherwise like. You know, normally, the credit union and bank loans are shorter term, say 3 to 5 or 7 years. Life companies, we found, are typically a little bit longer, more of a 10-year hold. So unless you're really planning on maintaining that asset the entire time, can be a little more expensive if you want to exit that debt sooner. Although,
just for the audience, I'd love to unpack what yield maintenance is. For anybody who has only dealt in residential debt, I think if you know someone's kicking around a 10-unit apartment complex, they'll be very confused and surprised when they realize that the debt landscape is much, much different than when you're buying a home. Specifically, when it comes to prepayment penalties, you know, you can pay off your home loan anytime. And there's no hit for that. Whereas in commercial real estate, you have to be very strategic with what kind of debt that you place on a property, because if you exit early, you're going to be paying these very large prepayment penalties, which is what the yield maintenance that Thomas is referring to.
Or you may not be able to exit early. There may be a lockout period, or right, there may just be a minimum interest period associated with some lenders. So you're right. Trying to get out of a commercial real estate loan may result in some surprises. Well, it shouldn't result in any surprises. You should have counsel representing you, or certainly someone like Thomas who knows his way around the documentation landscape to make sure there aren't those surprises. But it's not just pay off anytime you want and walk away, generally.
I wanted to kind of zoom out a little bit, because, you know, you turn on the news and it says regional banks are, you know, going to be in big trouble because, you know, commercial real estate is failing. And there's kind of these dramatic news headlines. This is for both Thomas and Charles, kind of make this kind of like a lending panel almost. What's going on in the commercial lending space, and how is Alliant positioning themselves? And, you know, how can you speak to
So a lot of these stories, the sky is falling stories, you know, center around office, you know, or at least they start with office. And it's hard to turn a blind eye to office utilization. It's pretty clear that there is a different paradigm at play. I'm not a real believer in paradigm shifts, but I think I'm sold on it here. And if you've got a lot, if you're a lender with a lot of office exposure, seeing it through to the other side is going to be tough. So are these repositions into multifamily? Are they repositions into self-storage? You know, what do you do if you own and or have lent on an office property in the face of the current dynamic, which seems like it's going to last, it's here to stay? And then that's used to say, oh, my goodness, interest rates have gone up, so values have gone down and everyone's in trouble. I think what we've seen historically is that Not panicking is probably the best course of action. And this too shall change, you know, and when a lender is willing to work with a borrower who may be experiencing distress, generally speaking, that produces a better long-term outcome rather than, you know, taking a club to the baby seal.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I think that's one of the advantages of working with a local lender or a credit union is that it's more of a relationship and not just a transactional. There's opportunities to sort of work these things out.
Yeah, but I think even if you have a loan that has been securitized, a CMBS type of loan that's been securitized, I think special servicers in general have moved away from the letter of the law as it pertains to how the loan was documented to what is a rational, reasonable, and best outcomes solution.
Yeah.
And to jump in there a little bit with the landscape too, just what we're generally seeing on our side, a lot of banks and credit unions are pulling back potentially on development. Certainly office and hospitality is almost a straight no-go right now if you're attempting to finance those. But they are still looking to deploy capital. They are still lending, and typically self-storage, industrial flex, multifamily still stay very strong. And so there are still loans being made. You know, if anything, we might be seeing leverage. So how much you can borrow against the asset being reduced or potentially spreads being widened. So how much a bank is particularly benchmarking off of an index such as five-year treasury or SOFR. That might be a little bit wider now, but their banks are still making loans and they understand we're in a high rate environment. And so there's some creativity going into those term sheets and deal structures to where I've heard some banks doing, you get a free refinance as long as you refinance with that institution, or reducing or getting creative with prepayment penalties as we're all hopefully anticipating rates come down in the future.
Charles, not to put you on the spot, but do you have any numbers? Like how many loans did Alliant do in 2021 compared to 2022 compared to this year? Are you guys
really I don't have numbers very handy other than last year we did about $1.1 billion worth of new commercial real estate loans with an average deal size of about $20 million. Our numbers are going to be down considerably this year. I'd say we are aiming to lend around $450 million, but that is a number that could well change as the year progresses. It could go up, it could go down, but 450 is kind of what we're targeting, you know, right now. And there aren't a lot of, last year, the market was awash with opportunities. Now opportunities are harder to come by. The opportunities that do exist are attracting a lot of attention. So even though there may be a general pullback in capital, the capital that is interested in commercial real estate converges on what I would call the good deals.
Okay, I really want to pull on some threads here. So that's half of what you did last, that's half, right, of last year. And yeah. I really want to kind of get into the whys. Is it, you mentioned that there's less deals available this year.
Transactional activity is way down. The buying and selling of commercial real estate is way, way down. I think there's, you know, whenever you have pricing or interest rate movement like we have, results in kind of a pricing disconnect between buyers and sellers. So properties aren't changing hands. I mean, that's one of the major factors behind that. Cash flow is not necessarily improving the way it was at the same pace that it was. So limiting what loan proceeds are produced, and that's requiring more equity. And equity is more expensive than debt, and making transactions in general less appealing.
Okay, so that's interesting. So it's not necessarily that you don't want to lend. It's just the availability of assets to lend to is considerably down. And
right, that's down. And then broadly, like I said, competition may have been diminished, but there's a lot of competition for the deals that I would like to lend at.
Yeah, makes sense.
So I want to jump in and ask, you know, I mean, obviously there's a big problem with office because, as you said, there's a massive paradigm shift in how we all live our lives. I mean, how many of us are sitting at home offices right now? But, you know, the headlines say, you know, commercial real estate is in trouble. If you remove office and maybe hospitality from the equation, I think that, you know, I would argue that the commercial real estate landscape is quite healthy. What are your thoughts on that?
And where so I tell you, our hospitality book is doing, you know, just fine. And maybe we've been really smart in the deals that we've opted to pursue, but we don't see distress in hospitality. We've seen a huge resurgence in the loans and the properties that we've lent on. It may be because of the destination-esque aspects and the restraint that we previously had. So that's good. In general, I've stayed away from retail, albeit retail, I think, has been resilient. And increasingly, it's of interest to me. Increasingly, I think retailers, purveyors of goods have decided that they need a multi-channel approach, that being online only is not a good proposition. It actually is a little bit more expensive than they thought. Rents probably have gone down enough in retail to make occupancy tenancy improve and a more realistic proposition. And so I think there are opportunities, particularly in grocery anchored retail, that I'm interested in lending on. Self-storage has been a great asset class for us. It's about 20% of our loan book right now. And we have learned quite a bit about the space over the last few years, thanks in large part to Thomas helping bring us along and educate us. And what am I missing? Industrial, has been a great asset type as well. A little bit of blending between retail and industrial. Industrial, in a way, has a retail component, a distribution, component to it. And just a general morphing and blending of asset classes, where you see storage going into malls and you see apartments being built around retail. The physical dynamic is changing, and I think there's opportunity.
That's excellent. What would you say in terms of, how banks underwrite these deals? Because I think that someone who is kind of new to the syndication space may not immediately realize that the largest investor in that deal would be the bank or the credit union, whoever the debt provider is, right? I mean, they're the ones providing oftentimes 70% of the entire capital stack. So what kind of diligence does Alliant do when it looks at a deal? And how does that relate to an investor investing in a deal, knowing that that financial institution is doing
that? Yeah, so I would tell you our due diligence is very, very expansive. We deal with very sophisticated borrowers. We are definitely not for everyone. Thomas can speak to it. There's probably more ease, a transactional ease, with a local bank that you have a depository relationship with, that understands that the property you're talking about is indeed at the intersection of Main and Main, and might be a little bit more lenient in how they underwrite, as opposed to someone like myself, who's a national lender who applies a intense review of the borrower, the borrower's other holdings, the net worth, the liquidity, shocking the borrower's portfolio to see what kind of impact distress might have on them, and then really digging deep into understanding the market and understanding the asset, because again, we're not living there, and there's no kind of taking anything for granted. So turning over a lot more stones and licking them clean before we put them back. Thomas, you've done business with us. How did you find the process? And you've done business, clearly elsewhere. How am I correct in my assessment that we're tough?
Tough but fair. And I think there's a component of you get what you pay for. And if you want those more favorable terms, more flexible or understanding lender, sometimes it helps to be more buttoned up and be able to pass that sniff test. Some of these smaller, more local banks might not fully know what they're getting into with your deal, and that could cause issues for you down the road if you become off pro forma, if they're expecting a certain covenant ratio, and you're no longer able to meet that, working with a lender like Alliant Credit Union, where they ask all these tough questions up front before you ever get the loan, can actually help benefit you from getting yourself in trouble down the road. And so while yes, sometimes it's a pain to deal with you guys, Charles, and we have to go external or find another lender out there, it's also always helpful to get that first brush and see what the banks or the credit union's willing to lend on and, you know, what questions are they asking.
Yeah, it, you know, one thing I would say is I know I was being fairly self-critical. We source all of our deals through commercial mortgage bankers, and we deal with, you know, the largest commercial mortgage banking shops in the country. And there's a lot to be said for the fact that these brokers come back to us time and time again. So I guess at the end of the day, we're rational and reasonable, but thorough.
Yeah. And what I think, just to kind of translate that to a pilot who's just getting started in this space, what Charles is saying is that when he sources these deals from commercial bankers, mortgage brokers, et cetera, he's not necessarily dealing directly with the lenders typically. He's getting most of his sourcing through people like Thomas Eddy, who packages up the underwriting, the lending package. And that way, a sophisticated bank that's going to give you great rate and terms like Alliant is more, you know, you're more buttoned up when you come into the front door and you have a representative sort of helping shepherd that versus, you know, if you're a little, you're not as buttoned up, maybe going to a local lender, that might be more appetizing than a more sophisticated lender like Alliant. So,
Ryan, to your point, borrowers are infinitely well served by having a finance professional whose job it is to be in the market every day representing them.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not like you're going and just getting a mortgage on your home, right? Where it's straightforward. It's, you know, I have this much down payment and this much debt. How hard can it be, right? But in this case, you may have different amortization, different interest. I mean, you have all that stuff on a home loan, sure, but there might be a lot more that goes into buying a 30-unit or 40-unit or 50-unit apartment building with capital improvements and different periods of interest only and amortization. So that's why having someone kind of help you with that helps you not only better position your loan to be approved, but also find and connect you with the best rate and terms for your particular situation as well. Kind of gives you that shopping, so to speak. Yeah.
And as someone out there looking for that debt too, it also helps a lot because if you're working with an expert, both in packaging your deal and then presenting it to the lender, and then you're also working with an expert group of lenders, and Charles, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys use those brokers because you have a very small, lean team, so you can work quickly and efficiently. Versus if you're just walking into your local branch and working with whomever there is at the bank, they might not be that well versed in commercial lending or the bank's terms to where maybe you're halfway through underwriting or getting closer to the closing table and the deal starts falling apart because something was missed that should have been caught much earlier on in the process.
Yeah, you're entirely accurate. To work with someone over and over again, you know, has its benefits. So you know exactly the information that I'd like to see, and you don't want there to be any last minute surprises. And your experience with our interactions and familiarity with what we want to do is critical. And as you said, we're then able to leverage ourselves by not having a direct origination team of our own. There are a lot of lenders that have a similar construct. So very, very few, national scope lenders, will go out and directly, solicit business from a borrower. Some do.
Can we put ourselves in the shoes of a pilot who has some experience in real estate and they're trying to take down, let's say, a $3 million small multifamily or, you know, 10, 20 units, something like that, or a small self-storage facility? When you're saying, you know, hey, it's really good idea to work with a commercial mortgage broker, what does that look like and how do you find that person?
Yeah, so that actually, the description of those loans are ones that I wouldn't do. They're too small for me. So, right. You know, Thomas right. would know.
Which I think is an important thing to know coming out of the gate is that that's a small balance. What would be the minimum that you guys would work with just to set the context?
Probably $7 million.
Excellent.
So how do you find that mortgage broker? Thomas, do you want to talk about how you're connecting with your customer base?
Absolutely. So, and one of the components there too of working with like national lenders or smaller lenders, data point that I ran into a couple months ago that I thought was really fascinating was the small local banks, so the non-top 25 banks account for about 45% of all lending done in the United States. However, those small local banks account for 67% of all commercial real estate loans. So while they're doing the lion's share of loans, the small banks are doing not the lion's share of loans, they're doing the majority of commercial real estate loans out there. And so that's where there's all these different banks, there's different brokers who have different areas of expertise. There's the bigger shops out there like a CMBS that could be really good at helping you take down a $100 million property. But to your point, Tate, if you're looking for a smaller $3 million loan, trying to find someone who both has the expertise and the network, but also the ability to give you that time of day, because unfortunately, some of these larger shops just, they're looking for those big $100 million hits. And even at Spartan, we've utilized brokers before, and we typically find they can be very valuable on those larger deal structures. But once you get under that $150 million breakpoint, we typically have a better time sourcing debt just because of our structure and because we go work with those local smaller lenders. So how does someone find us right now? It's a website, word of mouth, and this podcast. We're still kind of small and exclusive. However, that marketing is being expanded as we continue to see success and more clients come to us.
Yeah, I can't stress that enough. When we were first getting started at Spartan, we were looking for like $1 million, $3 million, $2 million loans for smaller self-storage facilities. And it was like everybody wanted to push SBA lending on us, which is fine. There's pros and cons to it. But really, we found a lot of success in looking for local lenders around the property, right? And when we talk about small banks, Thomas, can you kind of give us an example of like a small bank in Atlanta? Like, I think there's a lot of listeners in Atlanta potentially, or Chicago, something like that. Like, how would you find, like, what do you consider a small bank? I should say, start there. And how would you even go about finding a small bank?
Finding it is one thing. I'd say a small bank example, a really good one is out of Florida, Climate First Bank. They've been a good partner of us. Unfortunately, with smaller banks, you can't exhaust that lending limit fairly quickly. But if you're looking for under $10 million, they're still a great option. And they just got started 3 years ago. And so rapidly growing, they're starting to acquire, they're getting creative, they're very focused on green lending or different options. And so finding some of these small local banks that are growing is a good option. If you're in the Atlanta area, there's a lot of different online resources that you can just look through top banks within a geography. Typically, I'd say a small bank is someone with under $1 billion in assets. I think that's a good striking point. Depending on your loan amount request, that's important to keep in mind because most banks are going to be constrained to how much they can lend out based on how much in deposits they have. Not just for you as their client, but just as the bank's balance sheet as a whole.
Yeah, and our experience early on when we were investing, I'm talking about the first few deals that we did at Spartan. So if you're thinking about buying your own multifamily or storage and you want that $1 to $3 million loan, we had tremendous success with the small banks, but we also tried to use brokers. And what we found was, unlike Thomas's team, they weren't really all that motivated to go find, or we couldn't find a broker locally in that market that even existed that was sophisticated enough for the commercial product. It's almost like nobody exists in that like small niche space. But like Thomas was saying, we go for a $80 million, $100 million loan. Now there's a lot more people that are servicing that size of loan because it's a lot better. If it's more efficient, right? They can get paid more because they're usually getting paid a point or so on the loan balance. And so that was the niche that Thomas's team is really serving, is that smaller commercial space that's not as well covered. But the advantage we have is we've got relationships with a lot of these local banks across the country already because we're in these markets. So we wanted to connect people to those local lenders as well.
And two things on that one. One, to answer your question on how do you find these local lenders? Sometimes plug in the address of the property you're looking to finance, and then just search banks within a 5 or 10 mile radius and see who pops up. Avoid the big names and start seeing who's small and local that you're not familiar with. And then working with those big national brokers, you know, typically if you present a small deal to them, they're happy to go to market. But usually what happens is they're just blasting out an email to the 100, you know, deep Rolodex that they have. There's not actual conversations going on. So they could be going to good lenders, but because that conversation is never happening, the chance that your deal is actually going to get the look that it requires, especially in a competitive time right now, to Charles's point, it might be passed over when it shouldn't.
You know, Ryan, one of the things that I think borrowers need to also understand is they should work through an intermediary. They should hire a commercial mortgage broker to represent them for all the reasons that we've talked about. But how is that broker being paid? Is this broker simply collecting a 1% fee from them as part of the representation? Or are they getting a servicing fee or some kind of back-end fee from the lender? Are they motivated to truly represent your best interest, or are they perhaps representing their own interest? And that's critical to look at. And if you are paying them a fee, do they have relationships that will take you to lenders that also don't charge a fee? So Alliant recognized we want our business through commercial mortgage brokers. Because of that, we don't charge a fee to the borrower. We know they're paying, but they're paying they're paying Thomas and others.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That agreement that you sign with a commercial mortgage broker is super important to understand. When does the mortgage broker get paid? Is it when the loan funds, or is it when the loan is identified, right? So there's a lot of little tricky nuances there that might catch you off guard. Because we've actually used brokers where we were really motivated to close on a property. We found the loan. We ended up finding a loan that we wanted to go with. They found a loan for us, but because we had hired their services, they were still paid the fee, even though we went with our own lender that we found directly. So you have to be careful with those relationships. It's, you know, you could be signing exclusive agreements where they have to exclusively represent you, or it could be open where they just fire a couple shots at some lenders that they think might want the deal. And if they pass, okay, you can go find your own loan, right? So there's a lot of different ways to structure finding debt through a broker.
And I think it's important to work with one intermediary. There are borrowers who will go out and engage multiple or basically say, fine, if you can find something that's appealing to me, then sure, I'll pay you. And they do that to three or four shops. And then lo and behold, I see the same loan submittal come in from multiple people. Guess what? I'm not working on it.
Yeah, you're turned off, right? Yeah, because I mean, you get hit three different ways from three different people who are positioning it differently. Like, and it's like, so that's a reason why exclusivity could benefit you, because you're not all stepping on each other's toes, basically, is what's going on, right? So setting up that agreement, again, is just critical to your success to make sure you understand fully all angles of how it's being positioned to you, so.
And also, you know, one of the other things I would say is be forthright, be revelatory. There's Google searches, and then there's all sorts of different tools that we use now. And don't think we're not going to find something about your background. Better to put it out there. Mistakes happen. Own those mistakes. And as soon as we find someone has kind of obfuscated their history, that underwriting, terminates pretty quickly.
Yeah. And I also want to take a step back and be a little bit more basic here. So, you know, when you get a home loan or a loan like FHA or mortgage on your house, it's really all about the borrower and your debt to income ratio and your W-2 income and your credit score and all those things. When you go get a commercial loan, it still is about the borrower, but not in the same credentials that you would necessarily have to qualify for a home. So you may be thinking, man, I just quit my job. I can't get a commercial loan. But that may not be true, because it's more based on the asset and the experience of the operator or the borrower. Can you guys kind of speak to that and kind of demystify that a little bit?
I think it really depends. I think there are times when it is about kind of the ratios you've said in a very programmatic lending offering. There are, you know, checkbox lending businesses that are out there, particularly in the smaller space, and those things may factor into it. Once you go a little bit larger, do we look at credit scores? Sure, we look at credit scores, but it's not the end all, be all. It's really the ability, as you said, Ryan, for the property to cash flow sufficiently to pay back that loan. So how has the property performed historically? How is it performing today? How might it perform in the future? Which is the real driver. And are we dealing with an experienced borrower who has wherewithal, who has been through some cycles, who has shown themselves to be reputable in their dealings? Character, obviously, you know, fairly important to all lenders. But in terms of a rank order, it's the ability of the property to sustainably cash flow. Thomas, how would you add to those comments?
I've yet to find a lender who does not care about cash flow, or if I would not advise someone to quit their job and try to start a business tomorrow and expect to get a business loan on that. So no, to that point, I think the big piece is being transparent and upfront. My big thing is I always try to get to a no as fast as possible if a loan is not going to work out with the lender. And that just means being transparent, divulging any past issues. Maybe you don't have a job at the moment and you are going off of pro forma, but to Charles's comment, if you can leverage that experience, or why should the bank be comfortable with this expectation? It's really about the storytelling to the lender.
I might even be happier that you don't have a job and that you're devoting yourself full time to your commercial real estate business. I personally don't like real estate hobbyists. You know, I like real estate investors. And hobbyists are a little problematic for me if you've got too much else going on in your world.
So this is exactly why I transitioned from active investing to passive investing, you know, 6-7 years ago, is because I realized that as much as I loved it and as much as I studied it, and I just was going to be forever a hobbyist because I love flying as well. I had no intention of quitting my W-2. And, you know, something else that I want to point out is that $1 million to $10 million loan amount is just so difficult to play in. Once you go above 4 units on a tax parcel, that's some commercial multifamily, right? And you're in the commercial lending sandbox, and the commercial lending gets really easy when you get above the $10+ million loan amount. But something I kind of learned the hard way in my real estate investing career is that, you know, those $1 million commercial loan balances are really difficult to get. So honestly, I always liken it to being that doctor out there flying their bonanza on the weekend versus buying a ticket on a professionally flown aircraft.
You just took my analogy, Tate. Darn it. I was going to use that. The bonanza, the doctor on the weekend. Nothing wrong with the doctor flying on the weekend, but yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think is, you know, as we call banks, you know, early on in my investing career, banks want us kind of find the quick no a lot of times, right? And it's like, oh, you don't live near enough to the property. You live out of state. You have a confusing entity structure. You're just a Delta guy or a United guy. You're not focused on this property. You're still full-time real estate. Thomas, can you kind of speak to that? Some of the objections that you get, I'm sure you get objections all day long, and how you've overcome those objections. And maybe Charles, you could give a little bit more insight on this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it goes back to storytelling. Finance is about 50% the numbers, but also 50% the why, the story behind it. And so those are objections all day long. You've experience of operators, a big no. You don't live in the area that you might be financing the asset. And the big thing with banks and credit unions, any lender for that matter, is risk mitigation. So if there's a risk, identify it. Don't hide from it, but explain why you've thought about that risk and how you are mitigating it. With Spartan, you know, we're headquartered out of Colorado and we have an office in Seattle, Washington. We have quite a few of our properties in the Southeast corridor, and that's not an issue for us because we have our own managers on the properties. It's our own Spartans who are operating the facilities. We have economies of scale, so we continue to get to know the local markets. We do in-depth feasibility studies to show that we really are wrapping our heads around something and not just putting numbers in a spreadsheet and going, look, this is going to be great cash flow in 5 years. Trust us, Mr. Lender, I'd like a $10 million loan today.
Right.
Yeah. So with me, it comes down to experience. Is the borrower local? That would be great. If they're not local, who's going to manage the property? Do they have other properties in the area? I mean, they may be in California, but they own 5 properties in the city in Texas, and they have a local management presence. That probably works. Do they have experience in this, deep experience in this asset type? Do they have a track record of success that they can point to? Can they walk us through how they've performed, in various cycles? Where have they gotten into trouble? What have the resolution of those issues been? So it's, as Thomas said, it is the storytelling, backed by, really kind of facts on the ground. And it doesn't mean the borrower has to be on the ground.
How do you, Charles, handle, and this is for Thomas too, how much negotiation is available? So Thomas goes and finds, three rate and terms on a deal. And, Charles is one of those contenders. How much negotiation is available, and how do you kind of walk the dog there?
I mean, it really depends on how much the other side wants to spend on their legal bill. Generally speaking, I think borrowers tend to try to over negotiate, and what they get for that is not worth what they're paying. There is some latitude with respect to terms, but not an enormous amount. Nothing that is, when things go awry, it's going to lead to some serious conversations, and what the loan documents say, only have so much relevancy. Facts on the ground, the reality of the situation at hand is what's going to drive it. Generally speaking, you have rational counterparties, generally, not always.
Yeah, and I wanted to
protect yourself.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm not sure
go
you ahead, can protect yourself by negotiating and negotiating.
Yeah.
Right. And I was just going to jump in and take it maybe a step back on that negotiating for loan docs. I think there's a lot of different levers you can pull and negotiate with a lender early on in the term sheet when you're trying to obtain that debt. Are you offering recourse, as in personal guaranteeing the loan? How much leverage are you looking for? What kind of an interest-only period, if any, do you need, or an amortization? So kind of understanding what your most important goals are with your financing is helpful, because there's lots of different levers a bank can pull to get the loan to approval. It's just knowing how to navigate that with them. And that is one of the values that we bring if you were to present a deal to us to go out to market for, is we kind of understand and speak lenders. So it makes it a little bit easier to have those negotiations
before
an attorney comes in.
Right, Thomas, and which lenders will have that discussion. Alliant will have a discussion all day long about longer interest-only periods in exchange for recourse. Or, if you want to put an interest reserve in escrow with us in order to get some aspects of the loan changed to your liking. Other lenders, there aren't trade-offs. It's just, this is our program. This is what we offer to you.
Yeah. Yeah, and
that's excellent.
The last thing that I kind of wanted to jump in there is, can you guys just talk to loan docs, like maybe just keep it real simple, maybe 30-second explanation. What are loan docs and why? Because like you get the term sheet, right? So a bank might give you a term sheet, you give them the property, and then you get a term sheet, and your term sheet is basically just, it's the term sheet, but let's talk about like how legally binding that is, and then what is loan docs, and then sort of when do you know that loan is final?
Yeah, with us, we have deal screen calls twice a week. So our originators will review, call it 50 deals in 1 week, and we'll show up at deal screen with a couple of deals each. And they'll make a case as to why they, think this is a loan that Alliant Credit Union should do. Here's the risks associated with it. Here's the goods associated with it. And we'll have about 10 people on this call, and we'll talk about the asset, the market, the borrower, the potential obstacles and risks associated with it. And then out of that conversation, we may or may not decide to issue a term sheet. So the term sheet goes out to the borrower. The borrower looks it over, and some negotiation occurs around that. But it's not binding. It is not a binding document. Then we go into due diligence and we gather, you know, an appraisal, an environmental, an engineering report, a site inspection, and we do a fairly expansive write-up that goes into our loan committee. And if we approve a loan at loan committee, that's when we then move towards legal documents. We don't have off-the-shelf legal documents. Some lenders do. They use, Thomas, what's the name of the big one?
Laser Pro.
Laser Pro.
Spacing the name, yeah. So they use Laser Pro. We don't. We have, you know, attorney drawn up loan documents, and there's negotiations. And I'll tell you, you know, legal bills will range typically anywhere from 12 grand to 20 grand, depending on how much the borrower wants to negotiate. And like I said, you know, I don't think the guy who wants to spend $20,000 is getting their money's worth, but they might feel good about it. And, you know, from there, you know, once we reach an agreement, legal docs will be signed and the loan will fund.
To take the other side of that coin, I would say I've always had an annoying saying around the firm here, but every deal dies twice. And typically something's going to happen throughout that process that's either a retrade or a potential speed bump. And until the loan hits the funding table, it's not real. But for me, my confidence starts to come that this is actually going to close. To Charles's comment about once loan committee has blessed it. And that's typically once you've gone all the way through underwriting, all the documents are to the bank, and the bank's about to produce those loan documents for everyone to review with counsel and sign. That's where I start breathing smoother again.
You know? And so why do deals die? You know, deals die because we do underwriting and we were given a rent roll and told certain tenants were in occupancy. We find out, oh no, that's not true. You know, things like that. We're told the borrower has a clean history, and now suddenly we find there's all sorts of litigation. You know, they've sued absolutely everyone that they've ever encountered. So only the most kind of non-direct things cause loans to die, and we have very, very few. I mean, you know, in the almost 7 year history that I've been at Alliant, I would tell you we've had 3 deals, die during underwriting or terms that were changed in any meaningful sort of way. We try to spend enough time up front on these loans so that no one can ever say, hey, we were retraded. That's the last thing that we want a mortgage banker to say about us.
Yeah.
And as the borrower, that commentary of dying is multiple reasons. Could be phase ones, could be appraised values coming in low. There's a whole lot that could kill a deal. And typically I find everything has at least 2 hiccups throughout it.
Yeah. My war wounds here, my scar tissue on lending this is not in reference to Alliant. In fact, just quite the opposite. We've had an excellent experience with Alliant. But generally, when you close on property and you're getting loans, you should not celebrate that loan, those terms, or anything about anything until your loan is funded. And don't, you know, Thomas does a good job of keeping people in touch and the expectations correct, because it doesn't matter what your broker says until that bank has sent out the money to close on the property, it's not a done deal. So don't get too excited about your loans and just know that they can fail, and they probably will fail if you do this enough.
Hey, Ryan, one real quick example of how borrowers should behave. It was a hotel deal. I was in Florida meeting with the mortgage banker, and he said, the borrower wants to meet with you. And I said, no, everything's good. We don't need to meet. We're fine. He goes, no, he's not going to do this loan with you until he can meet with you. He has something that he wants to tell you, and he wants to tell you in person. Oh, okay. Next day, we go to his office, an accomplished guy, and he says, look, 30 years ago, I was convicted of a financial felony, and I want to explain to you what I did, what I was guilty of, and my history since then. And I really appreciated the guy being straightforward. When I tell you, when I said earlier, we will find out about your past. This was 30 years ago. There was no way for us to find out about this. It was actually expunged from his record at a certain point. Yet he felt compelled to tell me this story. And he said, look, here are the names of some very big lenders that I have done business with who will give me good references. Here's the names of some other lenders that will not come anywhere close to me because of my background. And it was I don't want to get into the details. It was a fascinating story. We made the loan to him and he's performed.
Yeah, that's being incredible. Upfront. And also bankers understand or lenders understand when your deal doesn't go to plan, and communicating to your lender early and often is a great approach too. Similar to how that borrower communicated up front, getting ahead of potential issues with your lender is also highly encouraged as a strategy to keep the relationship, you know, not just one-sided. So, yeah.
Definitely. Absolutely. Well, Charles, we want to be respectful of your time. We're over, and I'm sure you have big things as you do every day to take care of.
Primarily because it is late on a Friday, I would agree.
Yes, exactly. Well, hey, thank you so much for coming on. Before you leave, could you tell the listeners a little bit more how they can find out more about Alliant?
Well, I think the best way to find out about Alliant is by giving Thomas a call, quite honestly. Again, we work through financial intermediaries. That's for commercial real estate loan. For membership in Alliant, we certainly would welcome that. We think we offer a really great value proposition, the highest cash back on credit cards in the nation. I think right now we're paying the highest rate on share certificates. Again, another name for a CD on our 18-month product. Go to AlliantCreditUnion.com and consider opening an account with us. Like to have you as a member.
Excellent. And Thomas, how can people get a hold of you if they'd like to explore commercial loan options?
Yeah, happy to touch.
And if you want to get a look, feel, and smell for the type of real estate loan we do, just Google search Alliant Credit Union Commercial Real Estate, and you'll find our deals and our recent deals and some narratives around them.
Excellent. We'll link to all that in the show notes. Thanks, everyone, for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.